Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, I'm Parker Romaine.
I'm George Chen, and you're listening to SupDoc, where we celebrate the good, bad, and ugly of documentaries with insightful interviews, unscripted humor, games, and the occasional horrible impression.
On today's episode, we sat down with comedian Alex Hooper to talk about the Academy Award-winning documentary Man on Wire.
Man on Wire is a 2008 documentary directed by James Marsh. The film chronicles Philippe Petit's 1974 high wire walk between the Twin Towers of New York's World Trade Center.
The film is crafted like a heist film, presenting rare footage of the preparations and still photographs of the walk, alongside reenactments and present-day interviews with the participants.
Alex Hooper has a strong connection to this doc because he recently started slacklining, and we uncover the connection between performing comedy and walking on a wire without a net.
Yep.
Alex's new album, Hugs, Drugs, Pugs, is currently available on a Special Thing Records and all streaming services.
And now, here's Alex.
And in the living room, we've got Alex Hooper. Hi, Alex.
Hello, George. Hello, Paco.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah.
Glad to be here.
It's a comedian as well. Comedian Alex Hooper.
Yes, exactly. I don't know what you usually have on here. Rodeo clown, Alex Hooper. I don't know, prison guard, Alex Hooper is joining us today.
Well, I like it when people have done things before comedy.
Yeah.
Like when I meet like a lot of like lately, like 18 to 20 year olds that are just like at open mics, I'm like, what life experience do you have? Like, this is interesting. Like, I like it when people have had, like, Paco and I both had a lot of other weird like life experience before we got into this.
Okay, so then right. Duck boat tour guide, former duck boat tour guide, Alex Hooper, everybody.
Oh, really?
Is here.
Where was this duck boat tour?
Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Oh, nice.
I did over 1,500 tours in 3 years. It doesn't sound like it was like an NAM or something. I did over 1,500 tours through downtown Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I've never been the same.
That is like NAM, right? A little bit?
A little bit, yeah. It's
you were in the shit.
Do you ever go to the Millvale Industrial Theater?
Oh, I know about Millvale. I used to go over there. Mr. Smalls was a concert venue over there. It was in an old church, and I used to go over to Mr. Smalls a lot to see music. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
The one time I'd been in Pittsburgh was like we played in some gallery, but it was run by this guy who used to put on all the underground shows in Pittsburgh. Like, his claim to fame was that he had put on the Nirvana concert in like 92 or something.
There you go.
Yeah.
Somebody had to book him back then.
Did you grow up in Pittsburgh?
No, Baltimore.
Okay.
Yeah, I went to school in Pittsburgh, though. So that was my job during college, was ducky boats.
What's this? Is it Carnegie Mellon or no?
No, I went to Point Park University. Yeah, Point Park University. It's a small liberal arts school. Like, I think now it's up to maybe like 5,000 or 6,000 students. They grew a lot while I was there. They were in a very big growth period. But I was there, it was like 4,000. Just, you know, they gave me a lot of scholarship money. So made sense to go there.
Yeah.
What was your art? What was your medium?
Oh, theater, just like every other douchebag comedian in the theater. Like, not everyone, but yeah, I didn't know what to do with my life. So I was like, you know what? Pretending to be a tree for 6 hours a day seems pretty okay with me right now. So it seems like a good way to spend 25 grand a year, doesn't it? So.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
25 grand a year. Was it a public school?
It was a university, but it was a private university. I got a big scholarship though, like 40 grand total.
Whoa.
So I almost cut it in half. So which is why I went there.
And what was that? What was that based on? Did you do a lot of stuff in high school?
I could talk about this for hours. I mean, I dropped out of high school when I was a senior, ended up going to community college for a year, and then got nominated for this thing called the Presidential Scholarship based on academics, leadership skills, and community service, all three of which I was severely lacking in. But somehow I got nominated for the scholarship, and it was based on an interview based more than anything else. They nominated 250 to give it to 50, and I walked into that interview going, there's no way I'm not getting this scholarship. And the guy sat me down, he goes, tell me something about Alex Hooper I wouldn't know from your transcript. And I was like, okay, I dropped out of high school. And he goes, what? And I was like, because I had hidden all of that, I was like, I got rid of all that information. And the guy's like, you dropped out of high school? And I was like, yeah, I did. And he looks at me and he goes, you know what, that's exactly what this school needs. We need those students that know when they're done with high school and are ready for the next level. I can't tell you anything officially, but unofficially, you're getting this scholarship. I was like, yep, that's how we do it.
The Alex Hooper gift of gab has been paying off for a while.
Many years. My family always told me someone's going to punch me in the face. They never said you're going to get a $40,000 scholarship with that mouth. So, you know, use it
that's
how you
hilarious.
Will.
That's hilarious. They're like, you know what? We need some dropouts in this art school.
Exactly.
There's too many overachievers. Art schools can't have that many overachievers.
No, they need people like me to come in and shake up the status quo, you know, that aren't going to do their homework and studies.
You're like in the shadows of the school stairwells being like, psh, you need some drugs?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, yes. And you know what's funny? But what's funny about it is I look at so many of the people I went to school with that either got out of like acting or performing completely, and I just think that they all looked at me like I was the messed up one, that I was the one who had no potential. And I was like, no, I think I'm just the one that's being real about all of this and keeping my expectations grounded and centered to the point where it's like, you guys all want to be like Broadway stars. I just want to go, you know, be in some commercials or something and just make a living. And, you know,
Paco, you had experience selling drugs in high school.
Did I?
I don't know.
Your mom's Ritalin or something?
You've been accused of selling drugs in high school.
Oh, right. No, yeah. I grew up in a very small town, and I had my own apartment in high school. So I was the cocaine dealer that everyone thought I dealt cocaine.
Because you had your own apartment as a 17-year-old?
Yeah. And yeah. I was skinny. So they were just like, you put all those together. This kid doesn't eat. He lives on his own. And I also had a mullet. So, I mean, that makes sense.
And then you're called Paco. I think that helped.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That helps as well. So, yeah, sometimes you get slapped. Well, people just don't know what to do with people like probably like yourself, like you're saying in art school. They're like, we don't know what to do with this guy. He didn't follow the path.
Right.
You know?
I never have. Everything I've ever done, the reason why comedy has worked so well for me is because anything I've ever had to do, I have to do my own way. If there's a specific order in which I have to do things, like putting together IKEA furniture, my brain gets flustered and annoyed. And if I miss one step, I like break down and cry.
I'm like that too, actually. Yeah. rules and order are like,
I can't do it. And that's why I was so misguided my whole life, because I couldn't follow the rules or follow the path. And then so all of a sudden when I started doing stand-up and they were like, oh, people are like, you can just do whatever you want. I was like, whatever I want, you say?
But so let me ask
you. Act out on a podcast.
Yep.
Let me ask you this, Alec. I'm gonna raise my hand sometimes. I think it makes it a little easier. But let me ask you this. Did you follow the rules of stand-up, though? Like, when you first started, did you, like, read a book? Did you go to open mic and ask people how to do it? Or did you just...
I did. I started with bringer shows because nobody told me differently, and a friend of mine that didn't know any better kind of pushed me into it that way. So I started doing bringer shows, and I didn't do an open mic for the first 6 months I did stand up because nobody told me to go do that. And everybody was like, oh yeah, just keep doing these shows. This is what we all do, because I wasn't meeting comics that were serious about it. I was meeting other bringer show comics. Mm-hmm. So I started in LA and nobody told me better. And then eventually I learned, I was like, oh, I need to go to open mics. I need to go to like two or three a night and for a while and just kind of learn to discover what I want to do and how I want to be on stage. And then so I kind of started following a more direct route, but I always told myself in my head, like, don't look at what other people are doing as much and just kind of keep your head down and whatever you think an idea, no matter how crazy it is, just run with it and see what happens and let yourself fail before other people tell you that it's not going to work.
That is an awesome lead-in. Everything you just said is an awesome lead-in to
not
fucking Philippe.
Yeah.
Not following a path, not knowing the fuck you're doing, creating your own way, and having a singular vision because it's what you want to do. Fucking Philippe Petit.
Yes.
Am I right?
100%. Right. This, I first saw this documentary many years ago and loved it. And then about almost a year ago, I started slacklining myself, which for those that don't know, it's essentially like tightrope walking, except it's on a loose like wire, basically. It moves up and down and side to side. And every time I'm on it, somebody will walk by me when I'm at the park or the beach and be like, "Have you seen that documentary about that guy?" And I always be like, "Yeah, I have, but it's been years." So now to watch this again and listen to the way he speaks about just needing to do it, it's very I resonate with him as a tightrope walker, but also as a comedian of just like, I need to do this thing, and it's the only way my craving will be satisfied.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
So when you slackline, what is that, 3, 4, 5 feet off the ground?
Yeah, just like a few feet off the ground. I'm not ready to go over bridges yet by any means.
Right. If you could pick, do you have your twin towers? Do you have your place?
People do it in Arches National Park. There's a few setups that people have done in Arches or in Yosemite that I've seen like high wire footage of, and I would love to, like, in my mind, like, part of me thinks, like, yes, one day I will be able to do that. Like, I'd be strapped in. Like, I would have a leash on so that if I fell, I'd be okay. But I would like to think that mentally I could get to a point where I could get there. But the people that do that, I mean, it's literally, they dedicate their life to doing that. And I've met a few people, and that all they do is slackline. And I don't understand how they have any money or any. They just seem like they basically just seem like drifters, like, you know, like climbing vagrants. You know, there's a lot of people that live in Yosemite that essentially have no money. They just kind of live as poorly as possible because they just want to climb all day.
Right.
And I've met slackliners like that that are like, "No, man, you got to do it every day. You got to dedicate your whole life to this." And I'm like, "Oh, I dedicated my life to something else. Like, this is just a hobby."
Yeah. Well, that's what's bizarre about this, because I think about it, like, he didn't really, he wrote a book, but other than that, like, he didn't really get sponsorships or anything, like, Petit, he didn't capitalize off of it, and I was watching this more recent interview with him from maybe, like, 2014, where he's like, "Yeah, like, I don't care, I don't want money, I just want to be able to do this."
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's, you can live, if you have a singular passion like that, you can live very frugally and still have a perfectly happy life just walking on your wire.
He did get a groupie, though. We have to say that is a big part of this movie. Like, yeah, he gets a groupie at one point. You can have a tightrope groupie.
I feel like they probably left out some other groupies as well. Like, it did singularly focus on his girlfriend. They do kind of seem like the carnies of thrill seekers, you know, like tightrope walking.
Very much so. It's a rare breed that suddenly, I think, steps up onto something like that and goes, "Oh, this is the only place where I want to be for the rest of my life, is just balancing on this thing."
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this, Alex. I mean, this is one of my favorite documentaries. I was so happy when you picked this because I love this documentary. Can you set it up for the people who haven't seen Man on Wire? Yeah. Can you just kind of set it up for them?
Yeah, it centers around a man named Philippe Petit. He's a French acrobat and wire walker. And it starts off with him kind of going. He first does the Cathedral of Notre Dame in France, I believe. That's the first high wire walk he actually does. And then he does the bridge in Sydney, the main bridge by the Opera House. He like sets it up between there. He gets arrested each time he does it. He has to go through these elaborate schemes to be able to set up his wire illegally. And then he learns about the World Trade Centers being built. He sees a picture in the paper that they're going to build the World Trade Towers in New York City. And he sees this opportunity to have the greatest place ever to set up a wire in between. But of course, they wouldn't just let you do that. So he has to set up. It's like a heist. It's like a bank heist movie. It's almost as with the intricacy of Ocean's 11 or one of those movies. He needs a team of people to get him into this building time and time again, just so that one day he can set up a wire and walk between it, knowing he'll still get arrested.
You said this was like a bank heist movie?
Yeah. That's kind of awesome. How I see it. I mean, it really so little of the movie is actually him walking on the wire.
That's
because
funny.
It is years of buildup for him to be able to do this. And literally he gets the singular vision of this is the only thing that will make me happy in my life is walking between these two buildings that are not even built yet. And the fact that he has a team of people go along and you never learn what any of them do or anything like that. It just seemingly there's like, oh, these four people are like, okay, this is your vision. Well, then I will put myself in danger to get you there. It's so bizarre.
And it's an international team. There's like an Australian, a bunch of Americans, a bunch of French people.
It is
like very much in Z11Z. Yeah.
That's so funny. I've seen this doc like six times. I've never thought about it like that. It is set up like a thriller.
Yeah,
it truly is.
I mean, the amount of like times when they're just hiding in the World Trade Center's wall, security, and they're telling the stories of security guard walking by, and they would be underneath a tarp, like the three of them, for hours at a time, trying to not breathe. And I mean, and then when it gets into the fact of, well, how are we actually going to set up the wire and the trials and tribulations of them just actually getting the wire from one tower to another? The planning and detail of this, I mean, thousands upon thousands of hours were spent just to get to that point where you could spend an hour walking on it.
Even the little models they built, the little cardboard models, because this is another thing I was listening to. Philippe Petit got interviewed by Neil deGrasse Tyson for his podcast. They were talking about, just the fact that those buildings were designed to sway 3 to 6 feet at any given time because of, like, temperature fluctuations and just the fact that they're so fucking tall. And he's just like, you change a wire 3 to 6 feet and it'll just snap.
Yeah.
So they had to like build, like, I guess they didn't talk about this in this doc, but apparently in this interview, he was like, we had to put wood around the steel beams so that the wood could absorb the tension. Otherwise it would have just snapped from the metal beam itself, would have just cut the wire.
It's so insane, like the amount of like having to every single factor of walking on that wire like was thought about. And because it's in the same way that if one thing went wrong, like during a bank heist, then it's all going to fall apart. And so the planning and the frustration of getting to this point where literally this man could just do it, spend a few minutes.
Now, I have a question for you, Alex, because like I am afraid of heights. I would never do what you do. I would never do the slacklining. Now, the pole that he uses, the crossbeam pole, do you do that with slacklining?
No, slackliners don't need the pole. The pole is because the tightrope is rigid. So because it's rigid and not moving at all, the pole is to help you hold on to it to keep your center of balance. Mm-hmm. Where since the slackline, it will move up and down and side to side, it's your job as the walker to flow with the line. Mm-hmm. So the more rigid it is, it actually the harder it becomes. Mm-hmm. And so when I set up a line, like I'll have it like 100 feet long, fairly loose, so it will dip in and out about 3 feet or so from the like up and down mm-hmm. while I walk on it. And that's how you stay up there, is you learn to flow with the line instead mm-hmm. of fighting against it. A tightrope walker, from what I understand, I've never actually done it, but from what I've read, the differences between mm-hmm. a tightrope walker needs that pole to keep their center of gravity, right. whereas a slackliner moves with the line. The tightrope walker needs to just stay centered.
So in the last year, your core has probably increased.
Oh my God. I'm so bad. I'm so like terrible. Sometimes I'll just literally take off my shirt and like stand in my hallway, like with my arms up in front of my girlfriend, like standing there, just like, oh, did you see this, babe? How are we looking today? Like
you and Terrence Newman.
Yeah, just like essentially, it's the two of us.
Your Instagram photos together.
I have over the past year, my Instagram has been mostly me shirtless between pug yoga and slacklining. It's just been me in leggings shirtless. So yeah, I mean, my strength is. Increased so much. My mm-hmm. mental stability has increased so much. The amount of just like meditation that I go through when I'm up there and the focus that I have, it is literally, it sounds really cheesy, but it's literally balancing to have a more balanced life. Mm-hmm. It's exactly what it's given me. And I never realized the things it would do for me just as a full person, but man, it feels good.
What is like? Let's take just a minute or so and think about the parallel. I feel like there's a lot of parallels between stand-up comedy and slacklining and or tightrope walking. 100%.
I've never done either. Right? That's the point.
Yeah, no, I've compared these before, and it really like it's something that you can do by yourself or with friends. But once your friends can push you, but once you're actually on stage or on the line, it is completely up to you to. Control yourself and the line. If you think of the line like the audience, it's your job to control it, but sometimes it's going to flip you and sway you in ways that you weren't expected, and it's your job to understand how it's throwing you and get yourself back to what I call zero, which is being perfectly centered again. And there's times on, like, if you get a heckler that suddenly throws something at you and you're right. in the middle of a joke, it's your job to pivot and not ignore what happened. You can't ignore it. You have to just pivot with it and get yourself back to being the one in control. And slacklining is very much a part of that. As much as you want to progress is how much you will progress, and the amount of time you put into it is how much better you will get. Oh. But that feeling of when you're in the zone, like when you're on stage and everything's going right, the audience is with you, you're all one unit, but you're the conductor, and no matter what you do, you're in it. I've had those moments in slacklining where you're just up there and everything kind of drifts away and your body just and mind just take over, and you're barely the one in control anymore because everything, you just know exactly what to do.
Right. Awesome. There's also this thing about having like stand-up comics. We all have friends who want to help us out, and we like good buddies who we can tell our jokes to, who give us like some ideas for tags and punches and stuff. But then it's just you up there by yeah. yourself, and the best people make it look like they're just making it up. Like there wasn't hours of preparation involved. Yeah.
That's always our job. It's just like, how can it make it look like this was the first time I've said this, even though it's the thousandth time I've said it.
Well, someone like a Jean-Louis could be kind of like your friend that's just like, I don't know if that works.
You have to have a friend that's telling you like, look, I know why you think this is right, but please listen to me from an outside perspective. Like, I think I know what I'm talking about here. And like, yes, you can listen to them all you want, but in the end, when you're up there.
They're not doing it, yeah.
Yeah. You got to be the one that's up there.
But the difference is obviously the stakes of like plummeting to your death versus just dying on stage.
Yeah. Right. The crazy part to me, like in slacklining, you're taught pretty much to never look down. And there's the moment in Man on Wire when he just sits and just looks straight down. And I was just like, my stomach dropped out.
My heart
stopped beating for a second. Like, no. I was like, no, no. The whole thing is like, look straight ahead.
Yeah.
Understand what is below you, but like, don't look, because all of your equilibrium will get thrown off. And when the way he's able to lie down and just like look straight up, I mean, that is insane. I'm
fidgeting in my chair just thinking about it.
Yeah.
But also, like, did any of you guys see The Walk with Joseph Gordon-Levitt?
I have not seen The Walk.
I haven't either. Did you see it, Paco?
Mm-mm, no.
Yeah, because they shot that in IMAX in 3D.
Yeah.
That's like one of the options is just watching that. And it obviously CGI recreations because you don't have the original towers to reference anymore. So it's having a 3D version of that in like IMAX just sounds.
Yeah, so it must have been so crazy.
Crazy, yeah. But then Joseph Gordon-Levitt didn't really have to do any of that probably. But he seems like a weird casting for that. First of all, like he didn't look like the dude. I thought of like young Malcolm McDowell, you know?
Like, yeah, he very much looks like a young Malcolm McDowell. Yeah, very. I kept thinking that when I was rewatching it of how much he looked like Malcolm in his Clockwork Orange years.
Yeah, Clockwork Orange era, yeah.
George, you just wiped away my two games we were going to play. Which was a movie based on this story, multiple choice, and then cast this doc.
Whoops.
Well, they already made a movie based on it, and I don't think that's great casting. Did you have an idea for the casting?
Not yet. I was going to think of as we went through. Malcolm McDonald's awesome, though. That is a great idea.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just he would have had to do it 30 years ago.
Right. Yeah. No, that's how this game works. So when we play this game, it's good. Like anyone from any time period of actual acting.
You know? I mean, it sounds to me like we just won the game. You know,
I think we didn't
ruin it. We just like won.
We won
right
it without
bat.
Even asking the question. That's how good it was.
I just like to get the song out there. That's my. But the idea of this as a bank heist, a thriller, it does have a Guy Ritchie feel to it. Like let's talk about the style of this doc for a second. Like it's so slickly made. James Marsh is such a great director. You know
what else what else has he done? Are there things I would have seen? Do you know?
Well, Wisconsin Death Trip. Did you ever see that? Yeah, that's really
the Charles Starkweather Fugit murders. Which is Wisconsin Death Trip.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a documentary about that. He also did a doc called The King, I think, which I haven't seen, but he's a very slick documentary filmmaker. Like in this one, this is one why I think this doc resonated so much with people. It's so well made. There's reenactments and actual footage and maybe even CGI stuff. It's hard to even tell at some point.
Yeah, there's a very brooding overtone to it. It's very dark. There's very few points in the movie where you ever see sunshine. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a lot of it is in black and white because they use the old footage in black and white, but keep the new footage, like the new reenactment footage in black and white as well. So it has this dark feel to it. It's very ominous the entire time, which keeps you so engaged. They always make it like it's so imperative that this man do this, and all you can feel is like this is so trivial, this doesn't matter, but man, I want this guy to be able to do this, you know?
Yeah,
like you become he really allows you to become so invested in this guy's overall silly dream, you know? This does not benefit anyone in the end in any way except for this person.
Like that's like comedy.
Yeah, you can say like, oh, but the people on the street, they watched it and they all were amazed. It's like, yeah. And then they went back to work and went, yeah, I saw this fucking guy on a wire. This
fucking douchebag.
Like, I don't know what he was doing.
Yeah.
Causing traffic. Awesome. That's what he was doing. Yeah, in New York, that's all they'd say. Like, hey, we're trying to walk down here. Don't make us look at you.
I want no French body parts flying all over me. Freedom body parts.
Freedom body parts. I like that.
I mean, I think the film, like, actually, I was going to say the score is really good. I really like the score.
Yes.
Which I thought was, like, some old, like, you know, Eric Satie piano piece or something, but it was all written for the film, I think.
Yeah, but the score is amazing.
The reenactments also kind of took me by surprise in the beginning, because then they blended in, like, him on a unicycle, which I think was real.
So I mean, the guy, he's such a talented like clown kind of figure. I mean, he, you know, absolutely. There's times he's juggling bowling pins while walking on the wire and stuff like that. The amount of skills that he has where he can literally just go into the state of flow and just be and do these amazing tricks is truly incredible.
Well, I know the guy started in magic, and he also he stole a watch off a cop
who was
being arrested. He had this whole thing about picking locks. I think, like, he clearly like was just like, school is not for me. I'm going to like learn from the school of life. That's
he's almost like a non-malicious criminal. Like he just everything he wants to do is technically illegal, but in a completely harmless way. Like it's not actually no one's being hurt in any. Right. No one's being hurt. No one's really even being affected by his actions.
It's whimsy. It's like whimsical crime.
Yes.
Basically, it's just like finding where the laws don't make sense and then trying to insert yourself in there, basically.
Well, I think he was officially arrested for disturbing the peace in New York. I think that's what they...
Right, causing a scene or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is not much. I mean, I disturb the peace pretty much every day, and so it's not a big deal, you know? Yeah. One of my... he's so goddamn French. It's so awesome.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's like a little Puck character, you know? He's the kind of guy when – if you had a house party and he showed up, you'd just be like, fuck, hide the valuables and your girlfriends because this guy's going to break all of those things.
Here I am, young, 17 years old, with a bad tooth in one of those uncolorful waiting room of a French dentist. And it's really lit with a little 40-watt bulb. And you have all ladies and people, you know, sheepishly looking at magazines. It's quiet. And suddenly I freeze. Because I have opened a newspaper at a page and I see something magnificent, something that inspires me. I see two towers. And the article says one day those towers will be built. They're not even there yet. And when they are, they will become the highest in the world. Now I need to have that, this little tangible start of my dream. But everybody is watching, but I need that page. And so what I do is under the cover of sneeze, I see the page, put it under my jacket, and go out. Now, of course, I would have a toothache for a week, but what's the pain in comparison that now I have acquired my dream?
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
That's an interesting point, too, of this doc when he goes to Notre Dame for the first time. Like, it's his first, like, real attempt at trying to do something this public.
Yeah, definitely. And they almost seem like they're okay with it because they show that shot of like, I mean, I know it's reenacted, but they talk about like the priests, I guess, being below and then just being like, oh, there's a wire walker up there. Well, isn't that lovely? What a great thing for that man to be doing.
Yeah.
Call the cops. Yeah. But let's go watch.
Quasimodo. Is he dangling from the bells? Yeah.
Yeah, they seem to be pretty cool with it. I didn't expect that reaction when she's telling that story either. I figured they'd just be like, sacre bleu, like, get him off there.
That's all I ever hear French people
say. You know how chill Catholics are, you know?
Yeah, super chill. And then he goes to Australia, like you guys were saying earlier, he goes to Australia, the Sydney Harbour Bridge, and when he first meets the Australian that we are introduced to. In the doc, and that's another favorite part of mine in this documentary is the nickname, the AKA everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Reservoir Dogging of these people. Yeah.
Yeah. And made me wonder if it was because Philippe never really knew anyone's names is why it was like David, AKA Donald.
Yeah. He just got it wrong all the time. So they just went with it. They were like, yeah, you know what? It's better. I'll just be Donald from now on.
Right.
Yeah,
doesn't he seem like that kind of guy?
Yeah, because there was also wasn't it like it was Albert, but they it was all Alan, but his name was actually Alan, but he just went by Albert. Like it was close, but not right.
Yeah,
that's how I feel like Philippe. That kind of guy is we'd be like, hey, Pancho. You're like, it's Paco. Whatever, that's fine. Like,
yeah,
you're just never gonna get it.
I mean, we do that in comedy all the time, right? I mean, I'm just like, hey, you.
Yeah.
We met 30 times and I still don't know your name. I'm not going to tell you that, though.
I get a weird thing where people are like, your name's Greg, right? I'm like, well, that phonetically is not right, but it's like you read my name and then you reinterpreted the letters. It's not quite off. Yeah.
Greg doesn't work for you. I don't know.
No, you're not a Greg.
Yeah. I'm barely a George as it is.
I think you're a pretty great George.
Oh, thanks.
I think you've got it. Sorry about
there
that.
There you go. No, that's fine.
I apologize.
I grew up with all the George jokes.
I'm always never thrilled about when I do.
Yeah, fucking Alex. You know, like, I guess Clockwork Orange is a joke for you.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, I'll take it.
Yeah.
And then we get to the, like, when, like, the Petit putting all the work together to get to the Twin Towers, which makes up like the most of this stuff. And I was surprised. It seemed like he'd be the kind of cat that would just be like, let's get to the top. Let's rope this up. Let's just do this thing. I was a little surprised by all the work that went into it.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, the rigging is something that has to be so perfect without any error whatsoever. Mm-hmm. There cannot be any chance that you take, like, it needs to be done correctly one time, then that's the one time you're gonna do it. And so I mean I don't know how many times they actually broke into the tower, but it seemed like hundreds, possibly. Like, over the years,
months of recon.
And the fact is they had to do it before it was officially like really open and finished and all that. Like, that was the only way they were going to do it. And I mean, it's just incredible the amount of planning and work that went into allowing this guy to do this. And I wish I knew more about his cohorts and the people that were with him to be like, why were you willing to throw away whatever was going on in your life to help this man achieve this fickle dream of his?
It was the 70s, baby.
I guess so. Right?
Didn't one guy who worked in the building, the curly mustache guy, you remember that guy?
Yeah.
He had seen him in Paris do some of his street juggling. So he recognized him right away in the building, and that's, like, I think why he was on board.
I think
that's the only thing I can think of. There was one or two other people that worked in the building that could help him get passes and things like that. And then you had to, like, without a Kinko's, make a fake ID in, like, 1973 or whatever.
It's about a week ago, I randomly watched, there's this on Apple TV, there's this one channel called Red Bull TV, and I watch every once in a while I turn it on because I love extreme sports kind of stuff, and I watch it and see what's going on. And I watched this whole one. It was called about urban exploration, which is essentially getting into places that people are not supposed to go, and they have to climb to the top of bridges and stuff like that to get there. And so much of it was about having the man on the inside, was needing these people that worked in the building or for the construction company or whatever to allow you the access. And so much of you committing this crime is based on other people committing a crime with you just to facilitate you being there and being able to do it.
Well, that reminds me, I was going to bring up that you run a show that's essentially like a rave comedy show.
Yeah.
Do you have a lot of background in raves? Because that was the whole infrastructure of raves. It was like before, like, you had to like call weird phone numbers.
See, that was before my time. You call a phone number, then you go to this street corner to get where your guy's going to give you a map that has these other cryptic constructions. I never got to play that game as a partier, which I wish I had because it seems so fun.
That seems like half of it, really.
Yeah, it's part of, like, I used to tell people, like, we used to not tell people where Crave was while it was still underground. We'd be like, look, we'll send you an email the day before if you bought tickets. Then we'll tell you where it is. And people would be like, why can't you just tell me where it is? And I'm just like, it's part of the fun.
Yeah.
Just
it's treasure hunting.
Yeah, exactly. Just understand. I'm not even going to make you hunt. I'm going to tell you the address, just not till the day before. Like, but some people be like, fuck that. I'm not going through this. And I'd be like, okay, then it's not for you.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
It's
the personality types of, like, the rule followers and the people that are just like, why rules? And I feel like you're a why rules person. Like,
yes.
Why do rules exist?
I understand why rules exist, but if you're not hurting anybody, then I think it's okay to skirt around the rules a little bit, for sure.
And you're a Burning Man person? Or are you?
I'm going for the first time this year. I've been leading myself up to it for many years. I'm one of those people that could, people are always like, "What? I thought you were like born there, dude. I thought that was your residence." It's something I've been very interested in for a long time. I'm friends with a ton of burners, but being in the desert for a week like that is something that I've had to build myself up to. Mm-hmm. It's a very intense experience, and it can't be taken lightly.
Is there a crossover between like a slackliner community, or are you part of a slackliner community?
My friends and I, we have our own little name for ourselves. We call ourselves the Ball Slacks because we're stupid. I'm not really part of a slacklining community. It's kind of like I just really use that as my own form of exercise and meditation.
But it probably crossed over into like clown world, which I feel definitely. Like does cross over into burner. On the West Coast.
Yeah, there's a lot of it's definitely part of it. Is the reason I started doing it is because I was at a music festival and one was set up and I couldn't get off of it like for 3 hours. I was so committed to learning how to do it.
Yeah.
And so I think that was part of it. And I definitely there's a lot of stuff like in the burner world of this kind of circ, dancers and stuff like that that kind of fall right in with it. And I like being a weirdo. I like doing things that are just people are like, what? That's so crazy that you do that. Like I do like a part of my brain like really enjoys when people see me up there and are like, this is incredible. Like, you know, because it makes me feel just more like it builds me up, my confidence up even more. Mm-hmm. And I think my confidence over the past year has increased so much. And because I 10 months ago, I couldn't even stand on a slack line. And now I've had times I've been up there. My record's an hour and 45 minutes on a continuous walk of just staying up there. And the progression I've had in a year has just made me feel so good about myself. Yeah.
Just like competency in one area of like physicality can end up being competency in like your psychological state and your like spiritual kind of state.
It does something to you in the same way after you do a set when a bunch of people walk up and like, dude, you were so funny. That was incredible. You have this moment of like, oh, I'm doing this. Like I did it. It feels really good. And it's the same thing on a slack line of people just saying like, how are you doing that? And I'm like, oh yeah. That's right. This is like a difficult thing that I've learned.
So you're saying people come up to you after a set until you did well?
Sometimes. It's pretty rare.
I cannot relate. I can't relate to that at all. Yeah. I've never had that happen.
No, more often than not, it's like, dude, what happened up there? What did you think you were doing? Because I don't think we got it.
That's hilarious. I think it's awesome, too, that like there's sometimes you watch docs where for some reason the subject matter decided to start filming his or her life at like 5.
Yeah.
And then years later they do something amazing and then they can go back and use all this footage and you're like, how did they have fucking footage of this? And the fact that he was of the mind to start taking photographs and like filming stuff, mm-hmm. you know, back before he even did any of this stuff is pretty amazing.
I say European Arts Grant. I think that's probably
That's definitely what it was. They knew what was coming.
They might have had, like, I mean, because it was pretty good quality footage of just the training scenes and stuff like that.
Yeah, there were some things that he was doing that, like, I think about that a lot, about how I wish there's no footage of, like, early Craves, really, or anything. There's photos of everything, but we don't have, like, footage to show. Like, if one day, you know, I get the show where I want it to be, like, its own festival or something like that, I would love to be able to show, like, well, this is where we started, and, like, these little warehouses, now we're here. But I'm not the one who... I just perform. I'm not the one to like capture moments, you know, I just live in them and then hope other people are capturing it for me.
But well, there's producers and there's performers.
Yeah, you know? Very much so.
Let the producers take care of that stuff. So I'm not all that familiar with your show, to be honest. Can you describe what your show is all about?
Yeah, Crave. We've been doing it for over 5 years, and it literally started as like I was calling it Crave the Comedy Rave, and that kind of it basically because I love comedy and I love dance parties, and I wanted to combine the two, and I had these great like Burning Man esque spaces where I had met people throwing other parties, and I wanted to throw shows there. And what it evolved into after a few months of doing it was us telling these stories and scripting scripting themes around the stand-up comedians. So we would come up with a story and I would play a character and I'd bring other friends into it and we'd tell a story throughout the stand-up comedy all around it. Every interstitial is not us going, wasn't that great? Well, this next performer you've seen, it's us telling more story. So more is revealed each time until eventually... you have told an entire story, the comedy part's over, and then we just party. We have, like, we've had, you know, we have DJs, we used to have, like, fire spinners, and we've had, like, Cirque people and live painters, and anything we can kind of bring in to break you out of whatever reality you're used to being in, that's kind of our goal the whole time, is, like, we want you to come into an immersive world of just pure fun and entertainment. And we've been doing that for over 5 years. If you want to learn more, go to cravecomedy.com, and there you go.
And check it out. And those are – that's all in L.A.
Yeah, we've done it. We've done a couple – we've done some festivals. Like, we've done – we're going back to this festival called Desert Hearts at the end of April, that's based out of San Diego. But they're a crew that, like, throws festivals and are – really just great people. So we do like some small festivals and stuff like that too, but for the most part it's based in LA.
Right. Interesting. Awesome. That sounds like fun.
It's
sounds
real
like
fun.
I don't think I've ever seen a comedy show like that. I've seen, you know, weird variations on just the standard stand up, you know, 1:15 comic death march to the sea kind of thing.
Oh yeah.
But I've never seen like a story built around it. That's a cool idea.
It's a lot. It's so much work every show, which is why we only do it every couple of months, but it's always so worth it. Cause that's where I truly get to be whatever I want to be. It's like, want to see what's happening in my brain? Here's the answer. Come to grave.
Yeah.
When you do the sketches, are the comics involved in the sketches?
No.
They have no idea what you're about to do for the transitions.
No, and I don't tell them anything either awesome. Because I don't want the comics to have to learn anything or alter their set. Right, I just want them to show up and do whatever they wanted to do. Uh-huh. And then sometimes, you know, it's, you know, they can riff off it if they want to, because mm-hmm. I'm always doing something weird character-based, and they can – or they can just not pay attention to it at all. Mm-hmm. But some comics will go with the theme. Like, we did one, it was called Crave on a Plane. And of course, the comics, like Sean Patton, went up first, he's like, oh, we're on a plane? Don't worry, I'm a comedian. I have all the plane material. So this is all I'm going to do right now. You know? So sometimes it just works in their favor.
Nice. That's awesome. Well, speaking of doing characters, this is going to be an interesting segue, but Philippe, one of my favorite moments is the crutches moment.
Yes.
He steps on a nail. He could have gotten tetanus or something. Yeah.
I'm surprised he didn't, but then he's like learns that like, hey, if you're on fucking crutches, people are cool to you.
Yeah.
You know,
they'll let you
in without having to show your badges. They'll hold the door for you. They'll ask if you need a seat.
Yeah.
And, I think that's part of his clown background, though. It's like part of it being a clown is kind of just like is that moment of illusion of just fooling people into seeing something different, like the magician aspect mm-hmm. of like you're looking at this thing because really I'm doing this other thing yeah. that I don't want you to look at.
Yes.
And I think that was part of his genius of doing the crutches is like – no one everyone will just take care of me because they'll feel bad for me mm-hmm. and they won't think about that I'm actually trying to do this elaborate scheme.
Mm-hmm. It had a little bit of like Usual Suspects feel to it.
Very
like,
much so, yeah. Yeah, very, you know, very Kaiser Soze.
Yeah, when they're like...
Kaiser Soze whimsy.
Yeah.
Right. He is extremely whimsical, this fucking guy.
Yeah, I mean, you can't not be if that's your only thing you ever want to do is just be floating on a wire, like, above. Like, the amount of trust that he had with his girlfriend as well. Like, when they show that shot of him holding on a piggyback ride, walking across the wire. Granted, it's like 25 feet up, mm-hmm. but that's insanity. Like the trust between the two of them and the trust of himself to be able to do that with another person on your back mm-hmm. is absolutely maniacal to me. Like that was, that was insane.
I completely agree. I couldn't even get up a ladder that high, let alone get on a fucking line and have someone on my back.
Yeah, she's such an interesting character in the story because she like the way she talks about it, she's so enthralled with him as a person and what he's doing. Mm-hmm. But she even says at one point, like, there was no room for my dreams. Mm-hmm. It was all for him to get where he needed to be, and mm-hmm. I was on the back burner. Always like but seemingly they're so in love that she's okay just throwing away anything she ever wanted to do to allow him to have his dream
or being in love with a guy who you think is suicidal in a weird way, you know, like just being like I love him but he's about to do something that we all know has a chance of him just fucking eating it.
Yeah. The way she talks about him even after the fact of just like – of just how beautiful it was to watch him up there. You know, that moment where my heart stood still and I just watched him. And then – and – what's really crazy, though, is like because you don't understand that they're not still together throughout the documentary. Mm-hmm. And then there's just this moment where after he does the walk, when they're like, and that's when I knew I would never see him again. And part of me went, wait, what?
Yeah.
What do you mean? Why could you never? It seems to me that finally you can actually be together. Like, mm-hmm. finally his dream is, like, he can look more towards you, and he did the thing that he wanted to do for the last mm-hmm. few years, and instead it was, and then I walked off into the sunset, and...
Yeah. Parted ways, yeah.
I wish, again, like, I know there can't be more explanation, because part of it is just that mystery, mm-hmm. but I was so curious as to why all of a sudden he did it, and it was like, there, we can't be together anymore.
It's sort of implied, like, firstly, he does hook up with a groupie immediately after getting out of jail.
Yeah.
But they're European, so I don't think that's necessarily the deal breaker. Like, I think from an American morality perspective, you're like, well, then she must have just, like, been pissed. I'm like, well, they're both French. It's, like, not quite the same morality of the 1970s that you would apply, you know?
Right.
But I think she was saying, like, he was just entering a different phase of his life. And I guess she was just like, and we just were like, yeah, we're just kind of done. He's famous now. It's going to be different. And I guess that's the thing. I think anyone who's been in a relationship and tried to achieve this sort of esoteric expertise on something, I think the relationship always suffers, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's really difficult. Like, my girlfriend and I have been together like 10 years, and she she's not a huge comedy fan, admittedly. Like, there's certain things she likes, but for the most part, she's not a huge comedy fan. And it came up recently. I was like, how are we together? And she was like, because you weren't a comedian when we met. And I was like, oh. But you've been – that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And I was like – but she doesn't mind because for her, while a lot of relationships truly suffer because of stand-up comedy because like, hey, look, I got to be out every night. That's the way it is. For her, she likes that we have all this time apart because it allows our time together to be more special. And we don't need to be with each other every single night or even – two or three nights a week. Usually we get one solid night a week when it's like, hey, we're here mm-hmm. together. We have nothing, you know, I have nothing comedy related. And for me, it's actually like helped mm-hmm. all that.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of comedy widows in the world of comedy. You know?
For sure. Definitely.
Men and female alike. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just kind of what happens. And I feel like there's a spell. This guy seems like one of those like magical little characters you hear about in Shakespeare or Stephen King books where he just has this spell about him. I think this doc could have been called Spellbound if that hadn't already been a documentary.
As a child, have you ever played hide and seek in a park and take refuge behind a giant tree trunk and a policeman comes to the roof, and then your companion comes, circle the trunk, he walks, you walk, he stops, you stop. The man starts turning around this obstacle in the center of my tower, and I turn around on the side, diametrically opposed. This little pas de deux could go on forever until one of you turn around and bump into each other. Well, this is exactly what happened. He turns, I turn. He stops, I stops. He go on, I go on. Now, of course, if he would have turned around, oops, hide and seek.
He's not really a hippie in the traditional sense of like hippies or anything like that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think he's like part of like a countercultural thing. It seems it goes further back to like this, like, you know, like circusy kind of thing. It's not even,
yeah.
Like, even though they're culturally, I guess they were a little bit young for the hippie thing. Maybe if they were like, he's like 25 in 1974. I guess it's like he would have been about like 18 when all that stuff was going down.
Yeah. But he's like rural and French and has mm-hmm. a more of like this pastoral feel to him than mm-hmm. like a SF New York, Chicago hippie type.
Right. You know? Or like the French of that generation, I think like they got really politicized in like 1968 and stuff. And like, he's just like, I'm being whimsical. I'm, you know, like going to climb up a rope. So it's like not like that sort of like super political thing at all.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful thing just to like, even like where most of us just see like, well, like why would you dedicate your life to that? Like, why? Like, there's got to be better things. It's what he wanted, and he did everything he could to get it. And there's something about that that no matter what you do is extremely endearing, even if you're looking at it going, but he's just walking on. It doesn't help. It doesn't matter. His brain was saying, this is what you need. And he went through such a difficult series of tasks to be able to achieve it. And, you know, that's truly beautiful.
That is. I mean, that's what makes this doc one of the greats. I mean, at least in the last 15 years, it's like one of the top 10, top 20 docs, is that it has pretty much everything. I mean, including, you know, the people that helped him out now being talking about it years, 30, 40 years later, just crying because he pulled it off. You know, like, it's still a beautiful thing and so weird and different and individualistic and kind of like ego. I mean, not kind of, but extremely ego driven.
Yes. Very much.
However, he had these people on his bandwagon that wanted to help him out. I mean, it's a beautiful story. And I don't know. Let me ask you, would you think it could work today?
Like, do I think he could get away with doing something like that today? It would be so much more difficult. I mean, if you think about the amount of cameras that are just everywhere right now, and the amount of security, especially, you know, obviously those towers are not there anymore, but like even after 9/11, like everything of you making a fake employee badge to go into a building. I mean, just that, if you're caught, they're going to be like, what are you doing? You're carrying all of this weird stuff into a building. Like, I would have thought that he was going to bomb that.
I think that's what's interesting about this film, if you don't know, and this is my first time watching, actually, is that whole heist element. The first, like, 8 minutes or so, you can think that they're like, are they the Baader-Meinhof group? Are they like actually gonna like do a bomb, or what are they doing? Like, they're just sneaking into this building, if you don't know the whole context, you know?
Yeah, I think that's why I think more so often today people go out and do this over canyons and things like that. We're out in nature where they're not gonna get in as much trouble. But even still, I mean, I have some documentaries on like in Yosemite where, you know, people are not allowed to base jump or anything like that, and people still are getting away with that kind of stuff. You just except I'm going to land and I'm going to be arrested, but I got to do my thing.
I guess it's the same as someone who's going to cross, like, at a concert, go from the pit and try to get on stage. They're like, I know I'm going to get kicked out, but I'm just going to try to get on stage.
Yeah, right.
Right. Same thing. Actually, there was a guy there's some kid who I think was like only 18 or 20 who climbed like the World Trade Center that they're rebuilding, and he got pretty high up and just like was hanging with one arm and like documented on YouTube. And then there's that weird kid who decided to start climbing up Trump Tower. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
In, like, 2016. And it was, like, I was, like, this is kind of awesome. Because I think you even saw Trump down in the lobby just, like, staring up, like, what's going on? But then it turned out that he was a pro-Trumper who was climbing the tower. I'm just, like, I just am down for whatever. Oh, no, of course that's what it was. Of course he's, like, he's a MAGA climber.
I just want to be as high as I can on Trump. That's a get high climb on Trump.
Like, I just want to talk to you about some of my thoughts about immigration as I'm climbing this tower.
The wall is such a good idea.
But also, like, this movie came out in 2007, so it's made after 9/11. So it's, like, you can't help but – I couldn't help but kind of think about that aspect of, like, pretty lax security in 1972.
Right.
They, why would they ever consider that would be happening?
Oh yeah, well, they wouldn't have known like 30, 40 years in the past. Yeah. But
I'm glad that there wasn't like that the moment halfway through the dock where they show the towers coming down and I'm glad he just kind of jumped all of that.
There's so many documentaries about that if you want to watch that, and they're all on YouTube.
Yeah. Yes. There's just no reason, because it would have taken away from the story they were telling.
Right.
It's this isn't about being sad right now and remembering these like that's not this is a story of just triumph and you know.
It's like the anti-Altamont or whatever, if you want to think about like sort of like it's like you can't I guess recontextualizing it in like the fact that like everything now, when you mention anything about the World Trade Center post 2001, is gonna have this weird, you know, dark tinge to it. And this is just like, remember how cool the 70s were when you could just like have crutches and a mustache and like a hard hat and do whatever the fuck you wanted in New York. So maybe it's like yeah. that part of it. Yeah.
Including dressing up as a fake journalist. Journalist and
convincing the guy is like, yeah, you know,
we're doing a story in France
before the internet. Like, you don't know what the Mondo magazine of France is, or
no, of course not. Yeah. And you're not gonna just like, you see a badge, you're like, all right, fine, I don't care. Go
I think
up there.
That's part of it too. Yeah, like when you're saying, could you get away with this now? It would have to be a totally different type of thing. It just couldn't be like this.
I think they're very lucky that all he wanted to do was rig a wire and walk on it. Like,
clearly,
he very easily could have brought those towers down as soon as they were built, based on like what he did to get in there.
Yeah, just crank those wires together and like just get them to bend together and meet. That would have been another crazy move.
Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't think about that. Like, yeah, if he did have malicious intent, it would have been pretty fucking easy, you know?
Yeah, I mean, he would have gotten, because, I mean, he wouldn't have had to go up there hundreds of times. He could have gotten up there once or twice and be like, there, now I got this ton of equipment up here. So, too bad.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that, like, he ended up getting off with just having to do a juggling show for kids, like, after doing some jail time. Like, and then, like, he's just, like, balancing a police officer's hat on his nose while he's, in the holding cell or whatever.
That was a great shot.
That's New York City in the 70s, where, like, all you did was fucking break into the World Trade Center 100 times and walk across it on a tightrope. Like, you didn't fucking...
I am charming. I'm French and charming.
You have this, like, exasperated fucking judge in Midtown Manhattan who's seen it all, and he's like, fuck, I don't... juggle for some fucking kids. Get out of here.
Also, just imagine how much that guy would have dominated prison if he had gotten a harsh sentence, and he's just like this tiny French magician in prison. He's we're going to be organizing a breakout, and like, hey, cigarettes. Like, he packed a bunch of cigarettes.
Wait a minute, what happened? I went to rape you, and now you're raping me? How did this even happen?
Oh my God. Let's write it.
I took it.
Yeah,
exactly. I could see this happening. And I mean, that sounds like a good... What would you name that TV show?
Man, well, The Wizard of Oz.
There you go. That's good. That was... I'm not even gonna try. How perfect was that?
That was pretty perfect.
I just like... We should just write a fucking pilot. It's like a Russian mafia thing. It's like fucking History of Violence, but it's a guy, like a little like Warren Ellis, kind of like a gnome man who just like... I was a magician in Russia, and I joined the mob. And then, like, his whole thing is that he's a criminal magician. That's the opposite of the stupid Catch Me If You Can movies.
No, I like that.
Yeah.
Why not? Use your skills for evil.
I mean, those Catch Me If You Can movies are kind of garbage as well. They're kind of like more like they try to do the Ocean's 11 type thing in reverse. Like, we're going to do the trick, and then we'll explain it to you later, you know?
So, right, yeah. Fuck that.
If we can be so bold.
Magic, fuck it. I have such a fear of heights. I was going to say that. Did you guys feel that in this at all? I guess you have, like, you're off the ground, like, a little
bit. I'm only a few feet off the ground, so my fear of heights. The fear with slacklining with me is more so when I lose my balance and the rope snaps back. Mm-hmm. Because you get, I mean, I've had welts all over my body and stuff like that from it just snapping. Because you don't only fall down, the rope snaps up. So, like, you get double hit.
Do you get you land on your balls?
You know I have. That's just part of learning.
The slack balls.
Yeah. you're going to get it. You're definitely going to get bit. That's what we say. It's going to bite you. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's you know, I do have some fear of heights, but not too bad. Like, I'm pretty good with it, like, for the most part.
Like, this movie, like, there's so many times I just tensed up. Even though I know he lives, clearly, because he's narrating this.
Right.
But I just tensed up so much, just, like,
looking, so much.
Just being on the edge. Oh, man.
There's a part of those people that they you know, like, he says it. There's one point where he goes, but what a beautiful death. If I fell, what a beautiful death. There's nothing in his brain that's going like, you could die, you could die, you could die. Like, he's like, yeah, of course. But wouldn't that be amazing to just fall thousands of feet?
That's so European, too.
I know it is.
I feel like like, just like the American versus, like, European just take on this entire thing. I realize how American I am watching this. And just like, there are rules and you're not supposed to do these things. And just, even thinking about, like, any kind of like I really am just like uptight about this stuff. Yeah. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Like, even like the way you can kind of like be like, just follow your bliss. I still have like this thing, like, I gotta have a safety net, like, it's, of my brain, of like society and like
in his security. Mind, it's like, yes, I could die quietly, or I could splatter. And what is the better story? Oh. And if I splatter tremendously, then
right. People
will talk about this forever.
Like a terrorist. Exactly like a terrorist. He's yeah. like a terrorist of whimsy. He's like a whimsicist.
He's going to get 72 French magicians when he dies.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Like, we'll be showing each other the tricks. Yeah.
What's the theme of this doc? What do you guys think the theme is? Like, if you were to, if someone, like, what's the theme? Is it follow your bliss? Is it...
Persistence is definitely a major factor, I think, and just allowing your dreams to become reality, I think, is a big part of it, is going after the things you want and dedication. But sometimes I kept thinking, like, but what expense is this coming? Because most of the people talk about it that are around him talk about how wonderful it was to be a part of. But I feel
we don't talk
like
to that guy anymore.
Yeah, I feel like there was one guy who was like, I can't be a part of this. Like, he was like, no, you know what? This is insane.
An American, I think he got out right away.
Yeah, he's like, no, I'm not gonna do it. But I think I think following your dreams is definitely a big part of it, and just breaking and showing the world that things can be done. You know, that amazing things can be done if you just put your mind to it and believe in yourself.
Right. Awesome. Speaking of which, let's talk about your album.
Yeah. Let's do it.
Hugs, Drugs, Pugs.
You nailed it. I know. I made it specifically difficult for the order to be said. I've had so many people mess it up. But yeah, it's called Hugs, Drugs, Pugs. It is available now on wherever you listen to music or comedy, iTunes, Pandora, Spotify, Amazon, wherever. But Hugs, Drugs, Pugs are the three things that have expanded my heart and my mind the most over the years. They have come into my life in different ways and filled me with love and admiration for humanity, animals, and basically the entire planet. And when I was coming up with a name for my album, I was thinking about what a lot of the jokes I tell and looking over like the hour, and I realized like those were just recurring themes in my life that make me the person I am. People obviously associate me with like those things, like pugs and drugs a lot. I throw on a show called Crave. I have pugs. I made a calendar called Pug Yoga. Like, people see me as these things. So I'm just leaning into it as hard as I fucking can. I'm not trying to fight. People are like, you're the pug guy. Yes, I am. Like, I'm not going to fight you on that. Like,
I'm not going to fight you because you just called me the pug guy, which is the sweetest thing to ever call somebody.
Yeah, I get tagged every day in multiple videos of people that saw something with pugs on the internet and tag me in it. Like, and you know, at first, sometimes I just want to be like, guys, stop, it's enough. But other times I'm like, no, it's so sweet that people see something and immediately go, Alex Hooper.
Yeah.
Like, that's a very kind thing.
You never fucked with Uggs, did you?
I have a pair of Uggs slippers.
I think you missed an opportunity. This is going to be the next album.
I know. I could have had Thugs in there. I could have had Bugs. Like,
yeah.
Really? I'll come up. Next one will be Thugs, Bugs, Uggs. Start writing that hour now.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was so happy to get it down. And a special
Where'd you record
thing.
That one? Yeah.
I recorded Meltdown through a Special Thing Records, and they were so cool to take me on and let me do this the way I wanted to. And man, it just feels so good to just like, I feel like the legitimacy of having an album out that I can, like, people have come up to me after shows in the last week, been like, hey, where can I hear more of your stuff? And it feels so good to be like, album,
yeah,
like,
anywhere.
Type me in, type my name into wherever you listen, and there it is. So it's a big milestone in my comedy career.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Congrats,
man. Congratulations on
Thank
that.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah. And it actually seems like it seems like you need to do a video thing with Crave. It sounds like that needs to happen.
We've been making more, but we've gotten better with that. Mm-hmm. Like we filmed a few of them and stuff like that. And so we're starting to get better at it. It's just, my brain never thinks like the future. Like you're going to want this stuff. Mm-hmm. It's always, I'm so about living in the present and being here now kind of stuff that I don't ever think like, you know, in 10 years, people are going to want to see your origin story.
And that's probably helped a lot, actually, probably like just having that not, I mean, I'm sure you have goals, but like having that, the very present mind has to help with like not being overwhelmed by like desire for goals.
Yeah, I'm really, sometimes I look at other people that are like, I need to write a pilot so in 2 years it will go to series and then I can have, and I don't, my brain doesn't like do that very well. I just kind of like wherever the world and my brain and my path take me, I just kind of like, you know what, I'll just go with that until it doesn't work anymore and then I'll pivot again and shift into something else. And so far, I mean, it's taken me to some very odd places that I didn't expect to go, but I'm having so much fun and enjoying the process of allowing these weird things to come out.
Yeah, like actually, I was gonna say congrats on your appearance on Corporate. I
thought, thank you very much.
That was like a bunch of people I knew in a series, like you and Kyle Mazzono and like Deborah G. Giovanni. Like,
yeah, Greg Edwards.
And Greg Edwards asking for drugs. Like, hey, you got drugs?
Yeah, that was. I literally had a line in that show. I'm a drug addict.
I mean, that show is sort of like gonna be looked back on as like this sort of like peak LA alternative comedy sort of like moment, I guess.
Oh yeah, no, yeah. I mean, I
or even just in New York and LA people.
Yeah, it
was so cool. I was there on day one and two of filming. So I was there on the very first couple days. And I remember saying to Matt, Pat, and Jake, I was like, guys, you're responsible for millions of dollars right now. Like, we were doing open mics 6 years ago. It's like trying to be like, hey, wouldn't it be crazy if we had these things? And now you are literally responsible for the employment of hundreds of people. I mean, it was so cool to be there in the first couple of days and get to just do a little part on there. Yeah. You know, and
that's awesome.
Yeah, things will just come. Yeah.
And then you've been on Roast Battle as well, right?
Yeah, I did Comedy Central's Roast Battle. I was in the Roast Battle 2, and it was what a fun experience to get to do that on TV. Yeah, just be a weirdo and put on crazy costumes, and they let me do it my own way. Jeff Ross was very much like, just do you, Alex, whatever that is. Do it, you know?
Nice, that's awesome. Well, George and I are responsible for dollars by putting this podcast together, and
tens of dollars.
So, but thank you so much for being on, Alex. This is awesome.
Oh, what a pleasure. I'm so glad to watch this movie again. So thank you guys for inspiring me to watch it again.
Yeah, let's watch The Walk sometime and talk about it.
Yeah, right?
It's a biopic, so we can, you know.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt, he's played Edward Snowden and Philippe Petit. Like, just combine those. Combine a code-breaking nerd, Ty Walker.
Right. There you go.
All right, thanks, guys.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening.
You can find more episodes of SupDoc, show notes, updates, and more at supdocpodcast.com.
We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at SupDocPodcast.
If you have comments, corrections, or want to suggest a documentary, email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com.
The show is listener supported. You can donate to the show at patreon.com/supdocpodcast.
If you can't donate financially, please subscribe, comment, or tell a friend about SupDoc.
We'd like to thank Documentary News for their ongoing support.
SupDoc is produced by Will Scovel.
Our theme music is by David Siegel.